Chapter 3. Asher, the Bearded Jew, 1475. Master Tobias de Magdeburg, the physician from Trent, who reached Venice in February 1469 during Friedrich III's visit, had other information to be supplied to the judges investigating the death of Little Simon. His news was disturbing, linking the German Jews, reaching Venice in the Emperor's train, with the personage of the Candian merchant, David Mavrogonato, and his mysterious dealings. It seems that Mavrogonato, for the occasion of the imperial visit, had brought with him, perhaps from Cyprus, a large consignment of sugar and blood to be peddled on the Venetian piazza. These were expensive ingredients, indispensable to the preparation of medications and unguents considered of certain effectiveness and of great advantage by the pharmacopoeia of the time, and it is not to be marveled at that the shrewd merchant from Candia intended to offer them for sale at Venice, where all the Jewish physicians, surgeons, herb alchemists, and specialists, both Christians and Jews, had agreed to meet on that occasion, attracted by the prospect of a flattering and profitable imperial recognition. But, according to Maestro Tobias, those German Jews who turned to Mavrogonato in great numbers, known by them as the Jew with the sugar, to acquire the precious goods he had for sale, were, in fact, seeking to purchase Christian blood, and, in particular, the blood of Christian children, for use, not only in the preparation of costly and miraculous medications, but in obscure magical and religious rites as well. David Mavrogonato had no intention of dirtying his hands directly in negotiations of this kind, but used, as a go-between, an unscrupulous local charlatan, a certain hussar or osser, a rendering, in the Ashkenazi pronunciation, of the name Asher, corresponding to the Italian Anselmo. This Jew, from Cologne, was known all over Venice as the Jew with the beard. The name of this hussar, dedicated to shady dealings between Venice and the cities of the mainland and linked twofold to Mavrogonato, appears in the depositions of another important personality in the Trent trials. Israel, son of Mayor of Brandenburg in Saxony, was a young man 23 years old, itinerant artist by profession, earning his money as a miniaturist, and, in the case in question, as a binder of manuscripts and Hebraic and Latin codes. He, too, was arrested in 1475 in Trent under the accusation of complicity in the killing of Little Simon. He was to prove a bold and shrewd double dealer, agreeing in appearance to convert to Christianity and assume the new name of Wolfgang, not just to save himself from a certain and cruel condemnation to death, but above all, camouflaged by conversion, to assist the Jewish women accused and arrested for the crime, obtaining their release or facilitating their escape. Once discovered and unmasked, he was publicly executed in January of 1476. His body, broken on the wheel, was left at the place of execution, a spectacle for public mockery and a feast for animals. Israel Wolfgang had informed the judges at Trent that he had been Salomone de Pio di Sacco's guest in the spring of 1471, for the Passover dinner, with the participation of the banker's sons, David Mavrogonato's business associates, and their respective families. The patron of the house was said to have made use of dried and pulverized blood for ritual purposes, as was the custom among German Jews, dissolving it in the wine and kneading into the unleavened bread. Under these circumstances, Salomon's son, Salomoncino, in the presence of the brother Marcuccio, is said to have informed young Israel that the blood, probably extracted from the veins of a Christian child, had been supplied by a Jewish merchant, who had brought it from overseas, perhaps from the island of Cyprus, alluding, by means of this periphrasis circumlocution, to Mavrogonato. What is more, Salomoncino confirmed that the go-between in those sales was, as usual, Hossa, or Asher, whose business it was to sell blood from Venice to the other centers of the Republic in which there were active Jewish communities. The famous moneylender Salomone di Lazzaro from Germany, active at Crema and Cremona, was also an assiduous client of this itinerant wanderer. Wolfgang knew Hossa personally, and visited Hossa in prison near the Ponte di Paglia in Venice, where he was detained for attempting to sell alchemical silver, that is, counterfeit money. The reasons for this strange visit are not clear, nor did Wolfgang bother to explain. Perhaps it would not be too far from the truth to think that he intended to supply himself with powdered gold and silver at advantageous prices from the capable and expert dealer which Hossa was reputed to be, for use in miniatures of any codes which he might be commissioned to paint by rich and influential persons. This might explain the presence of the enterprising artist at Piove di Sacco, in Salomon's house, whose table would otherwise be inaccessible to a young man of low rank and without resources, like him. Wolfgang had furthermore come into contact with Hossa before, and knew that that alchemist of dubious reputation lived near the Rialto, in the direction of Mesta, and might be about 40 years old, dressed in black and wearing a beard of the same color. At Venice, Hossa was known by boys as the Jew with the beard. Hossa had a brother, some years older than he, called Big Salomoncino, due to his stature, and perhaps to distinguish him from Salomoncino di Piove, whose presence in the heart of the Jewish community of Venice and at the official ceremonies in the synagogue must have been frequent. According to Wolfgang, who made his depositions before the judges of Trent in November 1475, Hossa Anselmo, the Jew with the beard, had died about 6 months before, perhaps in prison. The information supplied by Israel Wolfgang de Brandenburg in his testimony is exactly, and very many ways, surprisingly, confirmed by the archived documents. Hossa Rasho with the beard and Selmus Judeusa Barba was in fact tried at Venice on the 3rd of September 1473 on an accusation of selling 2 bars of false gold, that is, silver covered with a foil of gold powder, to an artisan in that city, after having extorted the fraudulent official registration from the Assayer of Rialto, responsible for the stamping and weighing of gold. Hossa with the beard was sentenced to 6 months in prison and stricken from the registry of bulk gold and silver dealers at Venice. He was also said to have been compelled to compensate the victim of the swindle for the economic harm done, before serving his term of imprisonment. Strangely, the clauses of the sentence hint at the eventuality of an escape from prison by the Cologne-born Jewish alchemist, or his death in prison. In effect, as reported by Israel Wolfgang to the judges at Trent, Hossa died in the first few months of 1475, and it may be that he was still in prison. It is therefore surprising that the Venetian judges should provide in advance for such eventuality, almost as if they knew for a fact that David Mavrogonato's unscrupulous ex-right-arm man, dedicated to mysterious illegal dealings at Venice, where he was known by all, both Jews and Christians, had powerful friends in the mainland financial centers capable of helping him break jail or of silencing him for good, to prevent him from revealing his embarrassing secrets. Salomon Sinodopiov, who was perfectly well aware of the German alchemist's activities, may have known him personally during his stays in Venetian prisons, near the Ponte di Paglia, of which he was an influential and assiduous inmate. Just what the artful German herb alchemist Hossa was selling on all those frequent trips which took him to the cities of the Veneto region, apart from Medicinal blood and quack remedies of miraculous effectiveness and bright and treacherous silver of alchemy, in the manufacture of which he was considered a specialist, remains unknown. It is, however, certain that the merchandise to be found in Hossa's haversack, according to Salomon Sinodopiov, included one particular item, purchased from an itinerant merchant named Abramo, stopping by Trent in 1471 on his way from Saxony to Feltre or Bassano, and that this particular item was considered particularly valuable. According to Wolfgang's later statements before the Trent judges, Abramo's clients included the physician, Tobias de Magdeburg. Abramo's red leather pouch, with its waxed bottom, in fact, concealed a certain amount of blood, to be put up for sale, clotted blood, coagulated and reduced to curdles or powder, as was normal practice, to cause it to harden over time. According to Maestro Tobias de Magdeburg, many of the Jewish and German merchants who reached Venice in 1469 along with Friedrich III's baggage train intended to supply themselves with the blood of Christian children for the Passover rite, blood which Mavrogonato was said to have brought from Candia or Cyprus on that occasion. It does not appear that the Jews of that island had ever been accused of ritual murder at that time. Yet, Jewish Passovers at Candia in the mid-15th century were anything but tranquil affairs, and were often the source of scandal and clamorous indignation. During Passover week, 1451, the Jews of the ghetto of Candia were accused of crucifying suckling lambs, perhaps due to the impossibility of procuring Christian children. Note, this is not necessarily Professor Toff's opinion here. He is summarizing the Latin, Fortasque fideles paliros captain equivarat, in contempt of the Christian religion, with a grotesque and sacrilegious anti-ritual. The symbolism of the suckling lamb placed on the cross seemed obviously linked, in an intolerable and obscenely blasphemous manner, to the Passion of Christ, the Agnus Dei, Lamb of God. The accusation does not appear to have been completely groundless, in view of the ancient Hebraic custom of roasting the Passover lamb skewered on the spit in a vertical position, with the head upwards, to ridicule and deride the crucified Christ. Just how widespread this custom was, is difficult to determine from either a chronological or geographical point of view. The Venetian criminal judiciary was immediately informed of the affair by the Duke of Candia, Bernardo Balbi, while the Doge, Francesco Foscari, hastened to appoint Great Enigo, district mayor in the Levant, who was already on the island, with responsibility for investigating the matter, to obtain the truth about the crucified lambs in any manner whatever, identifying the guilty parties, and punishing them with the maximum strictness. Edicts were posted in the piazza and in the Gazzetta di Candia, promising cash rewards for anyone supplying the inquisitor with information useful to the investigation and threatening severe punishment to any persons with knowledge of the above-mentioned case of the crucified lambs who conceal the same. The well-known Venetian politician and humanist, Lodovico Foscarini, already Podesta magistrate of Filtra in 1439, of Vicenza in 1445 and at the time, Podesta of Verona, also occupied himself with the thorny matter. In a letter, presumably written between 1451 and the following year, and addressed to Antonio Greatenigo, Foscarini praised the Venetian inquisitor Greatenigo warmly for bringing his investigation into the sacrilegious sacrifice to a close, zealously and with undoubted success, and for his success in demonstrating the guilt of the Jews of Candia in the crucifixion of the lambs to a certainty. The outcome of the matter came to our attention through a Jewish source which has until now been misinterpreted on this point, the Chronicle of Eliakap Saley. The Candian rabbi, based on a report on the events written in Hebrew, reported that the investigation into the crucifixion of the lambs was concluded on the 26th of January 1452, when the Council of the Forty informed Bernardo Balbi, the Duke of Candia, that, as a result of Inquisitor Greatenigo's denunciation, 9 notables of the Jewish community had been placed in shackles for their participation in the crime. After a brief period of detention in the prisons of Candia, the prisoners were transferred in chains to Venice, where they were interrogated in expectation of the trial before the Avogaria di Commune. 2 of the prisoners died as a result of torture, while the survivor remained in custody awaiting the decisions of the Major Council, which met on the 15th of July 1452. On Saturday. To Everyone's great surprise, the Jewish defendants were absolved, notwithstanding Greatenigo's indignant protests, with 220 votes in favor, 130 against and 80 not convinced, that is, abstaining. On the 9th of August following, the defendants were released and left Venice. They finally landed in Candia after a 13-day voyage and were joyfully and triumphantly received by the entire Jewish community on the island. The report reads in part, in 1423, Francesco Foscarini was elected Doge of Venice. Under his government, almost at the end of his term, in 1451, the Jews of the community of Candia were falsely accused of the so-called calumny of the lamb, by an unnamed author. The matter took an ugly turn when Antonio Greatenigo, the inquisitor, visited Venice at the Avogaria di Commune to cause the Jews to be tried, setting forth the particulars of the accusations made against them. On the 26th of January, Bernardo Balbi, the Duke of Candia, received an order from Venice to arrest 9 notables of the Jewish community, after which they were held in prison for 35 days. The Duke then ordered their transfer to Venice in a ship captained by Giacomo Aponel di Candia, which docked after a 49-day voyage, during which the prisoners remained in chains, suffering terribly. At Venice, the defendants were thrown into a dark, unwholesome prison, separated from each other, and subjected to cruel and insupportable tortures and torments, which caused the miserable death of 2 of them in the sanctification of the name of God, but they confessed nothing. As a result, the case was presented to the judge of the Great Council. And the Jews were therefore absolved, thanks to the Lord's assistance and His mercy towards them. This happened on Saturday. On the 15th of July 1452. And on the 9th of August following, these same Jews left Venice, and reached here, Candia, 13 days later, expressing their praise and gratitude to God the Blessed. But the matter was anything but over. The implacable Antonio Great Eagle appealed against the sentence of absolution before the Avogaria di Commune. According to him, the Jews of Candia had bribed some of the magistrates, purchasing their favorable votes with money. Once again, Capsili reported that the allegation had been examined by the Avogaria di Commune in March 1453. The subsequent investigation led to the arrest of one of the councillors, Girolamo Lambardo, on a charge of corruption and Lambardo's subsequent condemnation to 1 year in prison. He was also struck off the roll of the members of the Great Council for 5 years. The fate of the Jews of Candia was again in the hands of the Great Council, which met on the 16th of May 1454 without reaching a decision. The meeting was adjourned on 7th of June following, when the charges were finally dropped after innumerable rounds of voting, on the 13th of July. On a Saturday in the month of Tammuz of the year 5214 equals 1454, in the afternoon, our Messer Antonio Giustinian's galley docked here in the port of Candia, bringing us the happy news of our acquittal. May he be blessed who rewarded us with all well-being, rendering vain the machinations brought against us. The Lord has saved, not only our fathers, but ourselves as well, our children and descendants. In fact, salvation has not only been granted to the Jewish community of Venice, because the Lord has thus liberated our community of the Jews of Candia and the other communities under the dominion of the Serenissima, and under the government of the Gentiles generally, from terrible danger. This sort of persecution is the work of the perfidious Haman, seeking to exterminate women and children, old persons and notables, and sack our property in one single day. Esther 3:13. Capsulis report, richly detailed, finds precise confirmation in the official Venetian documentation, supplementing and clarifying the picture. As early as September 1451, several months prior to conclusion of District Mayor Antonio Great Enigo's inquiry into the crucifixion of the lambs at Crete during the Passover period of that year, Gradenigro appealed to the Greater Council that the defendants be transferred to another, more pliable, level of the legal system, such as the Quirantia Criminal Council of 40 judges, to ensure a more expeditious conclusion of the matter. Great Enigo's appeal upon acquittal of the Jews in the court of first instance was preceded by a decision of the Greater Council to the effect that, in the interests of expediting the case, the presence of 300 magistrates should in this case suffice instead of the 400 judges provided for by law. What is certain is that, at the end of June 1452, 12 Jews from Candia were being held in a cell of the new prison of Venice. Capsali reports that 9, and not 12, Jewish notables were arrested in Candia. The idea that Capsali was simply mistaken seems implausible. Perhaps the other 3 Jews from Candia were arrested for other crimes, unrelated to the foul charge of the crucified lambs. It would not even surprise us to learn that David Mavrogonato, whose adventures as an intriguer with limited scruples did not always end happily, was one of them. These Jews at Candia were lodged in the same cell with the Christian, probably in jail for another crime, a certain Antonio de Spilimbergo. Spilimbergo was rather unhappy about being the only believer in Jesus Christ and the Virgin Mary in the forced company of these vociferous and arrogant Jews, who were as loud-mouthed as they were uncouth, and who did nothing but mutter their incomprehensible prayers and chant from morning to night, in Hebrew, with an unpleasant Ashkenazi inflection. Their actions, which the poor Antonio, out of ardent Christian zeal, presumed were highly heretical, as well as their strange and repellent garb, drove him practically mad. He therefore filed an urgent appeal with the commanding authorities for transfer to the Carcere Novissima new prison, a petition which the authorities immediately granted, in a full understanding of Spilimbergo's plight. The text of the defendant's final acquittal, on the 7th of June 1454, contains important details relating to the case as a whole. The principal defendants turned out to be the physician, Abodimos del Medico di Candia, who, according to the denunciation of a converted Jew, crucified the Lamb in mockery of Jesus Christ, at night, in his own room, together with other Jews, on the very holy day of Holy Friday of the year 1451. Gradenigo's inquiry shows that the Jews of Candia repeated this contemptuous ritual every year, in the days preceding Christian Easter. Abbe del Medico and the other defendants' attempts to bribe the judges were not in vain, as attested to by the relevant documents. As we have seen from Elia Capsulis' report in March of 1453, one of the members of the Greater Council, the nobleman Girolamo Lombardo, was arrested and sentenced for selling his vote to the Jews. The minutes of the Greater Council confirmed that an inquiry against Lombardo had in fact been brought and had concluded with the condemnation of the noble councillor for improperly attempting to extort money from Oba. As early as February 1452, the ineffable Candian physician Abbe del Medico, already under indictment for vilification of the Christian religion, was further accused of attempting to bribe one of the district mayors in the Levant, Antonio Bulai, one of Gradenigo's colleagues, perhaps correctly considered more pliable than the implacable inquisitor of the crucified lambs. But in fact, in a certain sense, Abba, rather than the author of the design to bribe judges and other high-placed persons involved in the trial, had himself been the naive victim of a clever swindle. Bonomo Demos, a Jewish moneylender active at Mesta, owner of the Bank of San Nicola at Padua, was, out of piety or self-interest, accustomed to visiting Abba frequently in the new prison where the latter was incarcerated. During one of these visits, Bonomo, who bragged of high-placed friendships in wealthy Venice, is said to have confessed to the impatient and depressed Candiota Abba del Medico that one of the district mayors in the Levant, Pulai to be exact, would gladly sell his vote in exchange for a loan of 50 ducats without interest. Having scraped up the sum, the good abbot promptly delivered it to Bonomo, who misappropriated it, obviously without turning it over to Pulai, who was completely ignorant of the whole scheme. But the whole scheme finally came unraveled and the swindle was discovered. The moneylender from Mesta, responsible for the swindle, was sentenced by the Avogadori to the payment of a fine of 100 gold ducats and 1 year in prison, after which he would be banned from Venice and its territory for 5 years. Abbe del Medico, for his part, was tried for trying to bribe a public official, but was ordered acquitted. The island physician was less fortunate, however. At the end of October of the same year, when his Christian fellow prisoners accused him of serious offences and blasphemies against the Christian religion. According to the denunciation, Abba, in his cell, was alleged to have unhesitatingly placed his filthy pisspot right below the crucifix. Soundly rebuked by the other prisoners, The intemperate Candiota was said to have replied with profanity, insulting them and shamelessly ridiculing Jesus the Messiah and the Blessed Holy Virgin. His condemnation was inevitable and well deserved, 1 year's additional prison time, in addition to the payment of a fine of 1,000 lira to the Avogadori di Gamune. But who was this Abad el Medigo, the protagonist, despite himself, in the affair of the crucified lambs? He certainly came from one of the most illustrious Jewish families in Candia, being the son of Mose the Old Man, rabbi and head of the community, and related to the famous philosopher Eliade el Medigo, a physician like himself. He had married Rit, otherwise known as Rivka, with whom he had had 3 children, Elia, Diamante and Ehuda, called Giuliano in Italian and known as Yudlin among the Ashkenazim of the Veneto community. The latter had married Sophia, called Shifra in Hebrew, the aunt of the chronicler Elio Capsali. The family lived at Padua, but after the death of Abba, which occurred rather early in 1485, he moved mostly to Soave, where Elio and Yudlin del Medigo had obtained the money-lending permit, which was renewed in 1496. Elio Capsali remembered that he had stayed with his aunt Sophia at Padua in the winter of 1508, on his way from Venice, and that he had heard her say that my relatives del Medigo were no longer at Padua, because they had moved to Soave. We know that Elio, Abba's firstborn, was murdered in Venice under mysterious circumstances in 1505. Implicated in the murder, one as the instigator and the other as an accomplice, were 2 Jews, from Sansino and Felter, the latter a resident of Manzalese, who were condemned by the Avogadori di Gamune to prison, the confiscation of their property and expulsion from the territories of Venice, Padua and the surrounding district. It is probable that Capsali stumbled across a copy of the trial documents relating to the crucifixion of the lambs on the island of Candia, in Padua, among Yudlin's letters, who had died many years before, stating the grounds for the acquittal, and that he used it among his sources. Out of prudence, or perhaps simply desiring to respect the privacy of the Medigo Capsali family, although half a century had already passed since these events, Elio preferred to omit any mention of the names of the defendants in the trial for the crucified lambs, mainly, any mention of Abad el Medigo, father-in-law of his aunt, Sophia, as well as of the assassination of the son of the latter two, Elio, committed at Venice by other Jews only a few years earlier. Lodovico Foscarini was a friend of Great Enigo, the inquisitor for the crucifixion of the Passover lambs, but he was no friend of the Jews, least of all of the Jewish physicians, whom he hated, feared and suspected, and against whom he considered himself engaged in incessant warfare, perpetuum bellum. Foscarini, the patrician of the Veneto region, recalled the manner in which the Jews, in their Passover ceremonies, solemnly swore on Mitra's scrolls to cause serious injury and harm to those faithful in Christ and place the Christians on guard against eating unleavened bread prepared by Jews. He was also convinced that Jewish physicians were the servants of the devil and were dedicated to the magical arts and to necromancy, poisoning their Christian patients in body and spirit. In a letter written in the summer of 1462, Foscarini considered it unacceptable that many governors, particularly those from Venice, tolerated the cheeky and arrogant presence of Jewish physicians and surgeons, and thus facilitated their presence, and maintained the presence for reasons of dubious honesty. Foscarini, then lieutenant of Fulia, had a short time before suffered 2 years imprisonment, lamenting that, during this period, the Serenissima, profiting from his absence, had signed official agreements with Jewish physicians. One scandalous example of blasphemous shamelessness, according to Foscarini, was a gowned physician, garnished in gold and adorned with jewels, who had had the boldness to turn to certain noble women in mourning, maliciously deriding their religious belief, and in particular, the sacrament of the host. "I pity you, ladies, for your ignorance," the learned Jewish surgeon is alleged to have said on that occasion, in a tone of open mockery, "in believing that your God, the creator of heaven and earth, would offer himself to be consumed, and thus does not therefore disdain to offer himself up as food to the jaws of obscene ruffians and the filthiest of whores." In view of the fact that the most famous gowned Jewish physician living in Venice in Foscarini's time was Chiara Messalina da Montecchio, who is said to have been granted the honor of the imperial doctoral privilege by Friedrich III during the latter's stay in Venice in February 1469, and that his quarrelsome nature, accompanied by frequent and intemperate verbal outbursts against both Jews and Christians, his true or presumed adversaries, was common knowledge. Identifying the gowned physician does not seem very hard to do. In confirmation of this, reference may perhaps be made to a news item from a Jewish chronicle, archived until a few years ago in manuscript form, and perhaps compiled at Venice by an Ashkenazi Jew around the middle of the 16th century, which seems to be a compilation of local traditions of indubitable antiquity. The presumable chronology of the events to which reference is made dates back beyond the middle of the 15th century. In Venice, the Jews were prohibited from circumcising their sons in the city. The Jews therefore had to go to nearby Mesta to perform this rite, which was fundamental to their family life. It was then that a Jew, among the most illustrious among those living in Venice, wishing to circumcise his newborn son in the city of the Lagoons, thought up an astute expedient which might lead to revocation of the discriminatory law. He turned to an influential Venetian patrician with whom he stood on terms of familiarity and friendship, a gentleman who was, in those days, confined to bed with gout, and requested the gentleman to act as godfather at his son's circumcision ceremony. The Christian nobleman was not only pleased to accept the honorific charge which the honored Jew had thought fit to entrust him with, but, being unable to reach Mesta due to his illness, which kept him confined at home, he seems to have decided to cause the child to be circumcised in the main room of his own palace. This was the first case, the precedent set up, thereafter permitting the Jews of Venice to circumcise their sons in the city of the Lagoons. If the report, as stated, contains a core of truth, it should not be very difficult, in this case as well, to identify the Jewish notable as Chiara Messalina, the influential imperial physician esteemed by Jews and Christians alike, particularly among the higher classes, to whom a son, David, was born in Venice, in approximately 1459. The Jewish community at Trent had formed relatively recently, and its numbers were always limited. When Maestro Tobias de Magdeburg, physician, surgeon and expert in ophthalmology, decided to establish himself at Trent in 1462, he found that there was no organized Jewish community in the city. In the early years of the century, in 1403, Bishop Ulrich III had granted a Jewish moneylender named Isacco and his family the right to carry on the money trade at Bolzano and Trent. This may have been the same Isacco whose presence in the city is attested to later, in 1440. It is nevertheless certain that other Jews came to join him in the first quarter of the century, staying at Trent for longer or shorter periods, such as the same Mose D. Samuel from Trent who, in the summer of 1423, made his last will and testament at Treviso, where Hed had in the meantime moved with his numerous family. The Jewish community of Trent seemed consolidated by mid-century. In fact, in 1450, Sigismondo, Count of Tyrol, decided to grant Elia and the other Jewish residents of Trent equality of rights with those of the Christian citizens of Trent. Nevertheless, when Maestro Tobias took up residence in the city, he found only one Jewish family, that of the moneylender Samuel Zanwil D. Seligman, originating from Nuremberg in Bavaria, who had settled in Trent 1 year before. The privileges accorded to Samuel in the money-lending permit signed upon his entry into the city were renewed by Giovanni Hinderbach in 1469, the year in which Friedrich III officially invested him with the temporal office of the Episcopate of Trent, at Venice, in 1469. In the meantime, a third family had come to reinforce the Jewish community of Trent. Angelo da Verona, from Gavedo in the Bresciano region, who had passed his youth at Canaliano in Fiuli, also moved to Trent, dealing alongside Samuel at Nuremberg in the local money market. Although he had lived in Italy from birth, Angelo, too, was an Ashkenazi Jew. Perhaps he no longer spoke Yiddish as his native language, in contrast to Tobias and Samuel, who had arrived from the German territories only recently, but he certainly understood it and spoke it, although rather badly. Angelo's parents, in fact, Salomone and Brunlin Brunetta, were natives of Bern in the Swiss Confederation. The three Jewish families of Trent were quite unrestrained and very definitely considered themselves a multiple of patriarchal nuclei. The married children lived together with the parents, and several generations lived their everyday lives under the same roof, grandfather and grandmother, uncles, aunts and cousins, married women, widows and unmarried girls, servants, scullery maids and teachers, travellers and persons of passage, more or less established and occasional guests, professional beggars and impoverished relatives. The Jews, whose habitations were contiguous, lived near the commercial centre, known as the Canton, in the western zone of the city, which included the quarters of the market and San Martino. Their lending banks, which formed one whole with their houses, operated in contact with the shops and taverns of the German immigrants, whose presence in Trent was rather large, amounting to several hundred people. German was spoken along the small canal which traversed the district, carrying turbid and muddy water, originating in the Adige. Alongside the evil-smelling workshops of the Germanic shoemakers and tanners were the banks and dwelling houses of the Jews. One of these, that of Samuel de Nuremberg, was the location of the synagogue. In fact, Samuel's family was beyond doubt the most religious, and the most highly cultivated in terms of Hebrew culture. The scrupulous observance of the standards of the Torah had induced the head of the family, in addition to setting aside certain areas as places of worship for the entire community, to draw water from the canal, which passed by the basement of the house, for use in a sort of ritual bath, where the women could easily immerse themselves for their own ablutions of purification after their menstrual period, without having to have recourse to the public baths, where feminine modesty and shame could not always be duly protected. Samuel himself, to great benefit, had studied in the famous Talmudic academies of Bamberg and Nuremberg in the years 1440-1450, and had been the disciple of famous rabbis. The oldest and most respected among the German Jews of Trent, his uncle Moser de Franconia, who had reached the respectable age of 80 and was known by everyone in the city as the old man, also found lodgings under his roof. Learned and authoritative, even if poorly equipped with purely economic means, he had found stable hospitality, with his family, with the enterprising and wealthy nephew, after having lived previously at Würzburg and Spira, one of the most important centers of Jewish culture in all of Germany. Samuel's household were strict followers of the rules relating to kosher food, which, among other things, prescribed the complete separation of meat and dairy products, according to the dictates of the Bible, amplified and codified in the rabbinical interpretation of the Halakha. To the judges in the Simon of Trent murder trial, interested in knowing why he carried two knives in a sheath hanging from his side, both Samuel and Mose the old man patiently explained that which, in their eyes, was perfectly obvious. One knife was to cut edible meat, while the other was to be used for dairy products. On the 23rd of March, eve of Passover of 1475, year of the Jubilee, the mutilated body of Simonino, a two-year-old child, son of the tanner Andrea Lampedorm, was found in the waters of the ravine bypassing Samuel's cellar. This tragic discovery triggered the inquest which was to lead to the accusation brought against the Jews of Trent as suspects in the child's abduction and murder, to their interrogation in the castle of Bonconsiglio and their condemnation, after confessing under torture to being responsible for this tragic wickedness. Finally, the condemned were publicly executed, burned at the stake or decapitated, while their property was to suffer bitter confiscation. The transcripts of the Trent trials for the murder of Simon, later beatified, are said, as a result, to constitute the most important and detailed document ever written on the ritual murder accusation, a precious document retaining the words of the Hebrew defendants, in which the words of the accusers and inquisitors did not always succeed in superimposing themselves over, or confusing themselves with, the words of the defendants. These texts are a glimpse into a different world, the world of the Ashkenazi Judaism of the German territories and northern Italy, in all its sociological, historical and religious particularity. This was a Jewish world, enclosed upon itself, fearful and hostile towards outsiders, often incapable of accepting its own painful experiences and overcoming its own ideological contradictions. It was this world which, moving from the negative and often tragic reality in which they lived, sought an improbable anchorage in the sacred texts which might illuminate a hope of redemption, which for the moment appeared beyond credibility, a Hebraic world discharging its energies in religious rites and antique myths, now re-enlivened with renewed and different meanings and translated into an alienating, harsh and rigorous confessional language, in which internal tensions and unresolved frustrations lay hidden at all times. A world which, having survived the massacres and forced conversions of men, women and children, continue to experience those traumatic events in a sterile effort to reverse the meaning of that world, rebalancing it and correcting history. It was a profoundly religious world in which redemption could not possibly be far off, in which God was to be involved despite himself, and compelled to keep his promises, sometimes by force. It was a world drenched with magical rites and exorcism, within whose mental horizons popular medicine and alchemy, occultism and necromancy were often mixed, finding a position of their own, influencing and reversing the meaning of ordinary religious standards. The participants in this magical mental horizon included not only the Jews, accused of witchcraft and infanticide, ritual cannibalism and evil spells, but their accusers as well, obsessed with diabolical presences and the continual search for virtuous talismans and stupendous antidotes, capable of curing and preserving the body and soul from the wiles of men and demons. Giovanni Hinderbach, Prince Bishop of Trent, the true organizer of the 1475 trials, had grown up in Vienna in the years following the great massacre of the Jews, accused of backing the Hussites 1421 and exposed by that same Duke Albert II to bloody vengeance as partisans of the heretics. Even before poor Simonino's child murder, when he had not yet risen to his official fame as punisher of the Jewish murderers, Hinderbach had already found ways to show his lack of sympathy for them. In one case, thus, he had not hesitated to express his self-satisfied approval of cannibalism, when the victims were Jews. During the military confrontation between Venice and Trieste in 1465, during which Friedrich III intended to enforce his rights, Hinderbach, who was then acting as imperial ambassador before the government of the Serenissima, sang the praises of the Habsburg militia, called upon to defend Trieste, for their courage and their demonstrated loyalty to the emperor. By true right, observed the pious bishop, the German soldiers, in case of necessity, rather than lay down their arms, were to alleviate their hunger by eating the flesh of cats, rats and mice, and even that of local Jews, Jews resident in the city. Friedrich III was, as Bernardo de Anville informs us, in addition to mathematical sciences, a passionate cultivator of astrology and necromancy, and for this reason is said to have remarked that he liked to surround himself with Jews and Chaldeans, people highly partial to superstitious practices. But Friedrich's faithful servant, Hinderbach, was no less so. Magic and witchcraft in fact exercised an irresistible fascination over the humanist bishop, who was a friend of Ennio Silvio Piccolomini. Hinderbach assimilated Jews outright with necromanticists, always ready to perform exorcisms and curses in the service of the devil. Demons love blood, and the necromancers who resuscitated cadavers used blood with little parsimony in their divination, mixing it with water taken from fountains and rivers. Hinderbach had no hesitation in maintaining that the Jews were enchanters and necromancers, because they kill Christian children and drink and consume their blood, as they did last year at Trent, and in many other places it has been discovered and proven. The practical Kabbalah, which these Jews followed more or less in secret, was to be assimilated in all respects to black magic and necromancy. It is to be noted that, during the first festival of the Sainted Child, held at Trent in 1589 with a great confluence of people, a celebrative pamphlet, later published in Rome, was compiled with the title of Ristretto della Vittoria Martirio di S. Simone Fanciullo della Città di Trento. This work maintained, in the wake of Hindelbach, that the child had been killed by the Jews, followers of the Kabbalah, vain science under which name magic and necromancy often hide. From the records of the trial, we know that Brunetta Brunlin, widow of Samuel de Nuremberg, who was, in the end, burnt at the stake as guilty of infanticide, persisted in her refusal to confess, notwithstanding the torments to which he was subjected. To Hindelbach, there appeared to be no doubt that the woman was ill and bewitched by Jewish necromancers. For this reason, every suggestive pressure exercised on the woman to persuade her to speak had proven useless. From shaving her head and removing her body hair, to ablutions in holy water. But the remedy was finally found. The holy cure-all, according to the Bishop of Trent, constantly in search of miraculous enchantments and narcotic unguents, had proven itself exceptionally effective in the precedent Santa Lucia case, in which the victim was also possessed by demons. Brunetta was placed in a bath of urine, laboriously produced by a virgin young boy of Trent, and suddenly, after the extraordinary, if rather evil-smelling ablution, the woman, without further ado, began to sign her confession.